Good morning, Mr. Yoon and Mr. Kuhn. My name is Thomas J. Thomason. I'm attorney appearing on behalf of the appellant plaintiff, Jong M. Ko. The basis of the appeal is an order entered by the Denver District Court, Judge Mullins, on March 27, 2008. The order entered by the court was a dismissal for failure to prosecute. The facts, I believe, are uncontroverted. The order was issued sua sponte without any prior written notice. The law in the case, the applicable law in the case, is framed by rules of civil procedure. Rule 41 specifically refers to the fact that if a trial court seeks to dismiss a case for lack of due diligence, the court may do so after giving reasonable notice pursuant to Rule 121. Rule 121, Section 10, is very specific. It delineates two circumstances. A trial court on its own motion may dismiss the action upon 30 days written notice to each attorney, or alternatively, written notice to the parties requesting that they show cause in writing why the case should not be dismissed. Now, the standard of review is one for abuse of discretion, whether or not the trial court abused its discretion. The case law that I have cited in both the opening brief and the reply brief is essentially framed by the 1986 Court of Appeals decision of Maxwell. Maxwell versus WKA Inc. Identical situation. Again, the court cites Rule 41B2, and the court indicates that notice must be given in accordance with Rule 121. The court basically says it is error for the trial court to dismiss where neither party has sought a dismissal and there is no notice or hearing on whether there is justifiable cause for dismissal. The court goes on to point that the appropriate method by which this can be brought to the court's attention is a Rule 60B motion. And it says the fact that the dismissal was erroneously entered without complying with the notice requirements of either Rule 41 or Rule 121 is sufficient reason to justify relief under Rule 60. The opening brief and the reply brief cite 17 Colorado cases, all on point. Those cases stand for the proposition that failure by the district court to comply with the procedural requirements of Rules 121 and 41 before ruling on a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute is an abuse of discretion and it is reversible error. The second point cited in these 17 cases is that Rule 60B5 is the correct motion to be filed to bring this to the court's attention. And the third point raised in these 17 cases is that dismissal is the severest form of sanction. It's to be reserved only for willful, culpable conduct consisting of willful disobedience, flagrant disregard, or substantial deviation from reasonable care. Appellee cites three cases. The first case cited is the Lake Meredith case. The proposition for which the appellee cites Lake Meredith in their answer brief is inapplicable. It is not what they cite it for. In fact, Lake Meredith stands for the opposite, and that is that you must have notice, and it is an abuse of discretion not to give notice. On pages 7 through 8 of the reply brief, the appellee cites the case of Schwartz versus Owens. Again, this case is totally distinguishable on the facts, which I did in the reply brief, and I don't think it's necessary to repeat it here. On pages 8 and 9 of the appellee's reply brief, they cite the case of Hesmer v. Hesmer. It's an out-of-state case. It's a divorce case. It involves a prisoner trying to basically file for a divorce from prison and not responding to the court's orders. The court dismissed the case. In that case, Mr. Hesmer was still free to go ahead and refile for divorce. The basic proposition, then, is that appellant has cited 17 cases. None are even distinguished. They're not even attempted to be distinguished by the appellee, number one. Number two, the three cases cited by the appellee are totally distinguishable, which appellant has done. And more importantly, appellee has not attempted to try and address the actual issues framed by Rule 41 or Rule 121 about notice having to be given.
Mr. Thomason?
Yes.
I take it that the fact that the dismissal was without prejudice does not help your client. The statute of limitations will have run.
Correct, Judge Richman.
Second question. When you frame you paraphrase Rule 121, you said it requires either notice, and you said, or alternatively, an opportunity to show cause, which I do read, I see the or in the rule. But in Maxwell, the case that you cite, it says notice and an opportunity to show cause, which caught my eye. And I'm wondering if Rule 121 was different in 1986 or that thereabouts when Maxwell decided in the copy that we're working off of today. I don't know that it matters, but I just wanted to know what the applicable law might be here.
I must confess, Your Honor, I don't know. The Colorado Supreme Court has changed a number of provisions in the rules. Rule 6 comes to mind recently, where it's been changed three or four times in the last couple of years about calendar days or, you know, what constitutes the computation of time. I didn't go back on Westlaw and look at what the rule said in 1986. I apologize. I don't know the answer to your question.
But in this case, you had no notice whatsoever, either notice to show cause or anything else.
Correct. Correct.
What do you make of paragraph 3 of Rule 121, Section 110, that says no activity of record in excess of 12 continuous months is prima facie failure to prosecute? Was the judge relying on that in this case?
Could not have. Could not have. And this is the reason. If you go through the statement of the case and the statement of the facts as I set forth in the opening brief, and I go through it in chronologic order and I set forth the specific pages on the record of appeal, the most recent action in the file was me filing a reply to affirmative defenses to the answer filed on behalf of Dr. Kumar. That pleading was filed with the court on May 30 of 2007.
9 months.
9 months. So, as I point out, the court also, in essence, violated the third, the 10.3 of Rule 121. And yes, I would agree with you, it's not applicable. So, the conclusion, I think, is inescapable, and that is, having failed to follow the procedural requirements and Rule 60B-5 being the proper motion, the order of dismissal for failure to prosecute entered March 27, 2008 should be vacated. The case should be remanded and reinstated, and it should go forward at this point to determine what is the status of the remaining defendant, Denver Orthopedic. That has still never been determined. The case was not at issue and is still not at issue because there was an open defendant who, while having been served, there was no disposition in the way of an answer or other responsive pleading. So the case was not at issue pursuant to Rule 16B1. Unquestionably, it was not at issue. That was admitted in Exhibit 7 by Mr. Kuhn in a letter to me of July 6, 2007, and I acknowledged it to him in Exhibit 5, which is attached to the record on appeal, in a letter dated June 18, 2007, saying we need to move this thing along and find out what's the status of Denver Orthopedic. We need an affidavit from Dr. Wong about the status of the entity, because two defendants were served, two defendants were named, answer filed on behalf of one, but no responsive pleadings at all filed on behalf of the other defendant.
But no default motion filed by you?
No.
The delay reduction order requests that, doesn't it, or urges that?
Well, that's an interesting question, and of course the record as it developed was that I was trying to work cooperatively with Mr. Kuhn, and we were trying to establish the status of the orthopedic clinic. Was it still in existence? Did it have any assets? Did it have any coverage? That's the main question. I see that, I think, that means
no,
I have...
No good deed goes unpunished, you know. You're working cooperatively.
Working cooperatively. I've done it for 34 years, Your Honor, and I still believe it's the way to conduct one's affairs. Does the yellow... I apologize. Does the yellow light mean I have 5 minutes?
Yes, sir.
May I please reserve that with the permission of the court?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Yoon. I, along with Mr. Kevin Kuhn, sitting at counsel's table, represent defendant Appley. The trial court entered this order for failure to prosecute without prejudice on March 27th, 2008, almost 3 years and 3 months after the case was originally filed. And the trial court ruled, and I believe I provided the court with a court ruling, but let me read it to you. The action was filed on or about January 6, 2005. The last pleading received by the court was more than 9 months ago. Since that time, no progress has been made toward prosecuting or otherwise resolving the matter. Such lack of due diligence constitutes a failure to prosecute pursuant to Rule 121, Section 110. This court, as counsel mentioned, reviews the trial court's order to failure to prosecute for abuse of discretion. Unless the order is arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable, the trial court's decision should be affirmed.
Can't we also find an abuse of discretion if the trial court acted contrary to applicable law, which would include the rules of civil procedure?
Yes, Your Honor. Inconsistency with the law is an abuse of discretion. And the central issue in this case, we believe, is whether the delay reduction order entered at the inception of the case is sufficient notice under Rule 121, Section 110. And Rule 121, Section 110 states in its pertinent parts that the court, on its own motion, may dismiss any action not prosecuted with due diligence upon 30 days notice in writing to each attorney of record and each appearing party who are not represented by counsel. In this case, the trial court entered a delay reduction order on January 18th, 2005, stating as follows. If an attorney or pro se party fails to comply with part one of this order, the court may dismiss the case without prejudice. The order shall be the initial notice required by Rule 121, Section 110. Part one of the delay reduction order sets forth basic deadlines, all aimed at getting the case at issue and setting for trial.
Let me stop you, Mr. Young. It says, as you just read it, this shall be the initial notice required. Doesn't that imply there'll be a further notice required? And there was no further notice. You don't argue that, do you?
There was no further notice, but I don't think the Rule 121 requires more than one notice.
But the delay reduction order says initial notice, and it implies that there would be a further notice, does it not?
I don't think that's the implication is clear. I don't think the court can read into the delay reduction order to say that there'll be another notice. It does say that if you don't comply with these deadlines, the court may dismiss the lawsuit without prejudice.
Which of the three subparagraphs of Roman 1 were not complied with according to your position?
Number two and number three. Both the application of default judgment and not setting the case for trial within 30 days after the case is at issue.
But Mr. Tomazin says it was never at issue because, I forget the name, but the corporate defendant didn't appear.
Mr. Tomlinson accurately stated what happened. There were two defendants, as the court mentioned. There was a PC and Dr. Kumar. After taking 2 years to serve the defendants, plaintiff did nothing to make the case at issue. Initially, when they filed the return of service, which was filed on March 30th, 2007, a year before the lawsuit was filed, Mr. Tomlinson asked for an affidavit stating why the PC should not be in the case. By August 2007, over 7 months before the case was dismissed, defense counsel provided him with an affidavit explaining that the PC was defunct, that there was no insurance coverage, and sending a notice of dismissal for Mr. Thomason's sign and file. And plaintiff's counsel didn't do anything with that.
But the corporate defendant didn't file an answer.
Well,
it didn't file a motion. It didn't file a responsive pleading at all, did it?
No, it did not.
It provided this affidavit. And I understand why he did it, but it was never taken care of. There was never a responsive pleading or a dismissal filed, so that party was still hanging out there in March of 2008 when the judge entered this order, right?
Yes. The plaintiff, as the court knows, the plaintiff has an obligation. It bears the burden of prosecuting the case. The delay redaction order placed the burden on the plaintiff to move the case along. The delay reduction order says, get this case at issue. To get the case at issue, all the parties have to file their answers or dismissals or default judgment has to be entered. In this case, we provided the information for plaintiff's counsel to dismiss the PC by August of 2007, and he didn't do anything with it.
August and March, he didn't do anything to deal with that defendant. Between August 2007
yes.
and March 2008, when the judge entered his order,
yes.
nothing was done with that defendant.
Yes. Okay. More importantly, plaintiff's counsel had an obligation to inform the court why the case was not at issue. He filed, as counsel mentioned, he filed a return of service on March 30th for the PC, March 30, 2007, almost a year before. From that point forward, he didn't inform the court, I need more time to comply with this delay reduction order. And plaintiff's counsel was well aware of the delay reduction order because he had filed 13 motions for enlargement of time to comply with the delay reduction order to serve the defendant. So he was well aware of it, but for some reason, he did not comply with paragraph 2 and paragraph 3. And by that point, a year passes and the court had enough. This case was sitting on the court's docket for 3 years and 3 months, and the case was not even at issue. And I think that...
Let me ask another question. This is the same question I asked the other counsel. The Maxwell case says that the parties have to be given 30 days written notice and an opportunity to show cause. Here you say the notice was given by virtue of the delay reduction order, but it doesn't say anything about having an opportunity to show cause why dismissal should not be affected. Isn't it required that he be given an opportunity to show cause under the Maxwell case?
I believe the rule is contrary. The rule says that a court on its own motion may dismiss a case upon 30 days notice or upon showing of cause. If you always have to show cause, then the first part of that sentence would become superfluous. Therefore, I think the rule 121, only requires a 30 days notice before dismissal.
So was the rule different at the time Maxwell was decided? This is my question to the other counsel.
I do not believe it was different, but I don't think the court was careful in looking at that there's an or to the rule.
In the Maxwell case?
Yes. And I think the point was in Maxwell case and all of the cases that they cite do not have anything to do with delay reduction order and whether that is sufficient for notice. All of those cases are talking about where there was absolutely no notice given. In this case, we have a delay reduction order that says this is notice pursuant to Rule 121, Section 110, and that the case may be dismissed. And I believe that is sufficient notice.
Let me direct your attention to in Rule 121, 1-10, paren 4, which says failure to show cause on or before the date set forth in the court's notice shall justify dismissal without further proceedings. With me?
Yes.
Okay, well, if we treat the delay reduction order as the court's notice, which is your argument, correct?
Yes.
Well, then how does the delay reduction order lead to a period of time during which
cause can be shown. It says failure to show cause on or before the date set forth in the court's notice. The delay reduction order doesn't set a notice date for showing cause.
I believe, Your Honor, the way I read the rule is paragraph 2 has two provisions. One is 30-day notice or show cause. If the show cause provision was applicable in this case, then you would have paragraph 4 applicable. I don't think it's triggered until the second part of paragraph 2 is applicable. Where?
Well, then what is the 30-day notice supposed to say? If it doesn't say, I mean, what these orders always say is this case will be dismissed if you do not show cause why it should not. That's what these orders always say. What is the 30-day notice supposed to say if it doesn't give them the opportunity to show cause why it should be dismissed? What is it going to say?
In this order, the court says you have 3 deadlines. Please satisfy them or else the case may be dismissed without prejudice. And this is initial notice under Rule 121. That is what it says, and that is what I think is required.
All right.
The second provision, the show cause, is different. I don't think the rule requires show cause because it includes an or in the paragraph
so
2.
So in any court where the delay reduction order is a standard practice, as I think it is in Denver and many other courts, this provision of subsection 110, 30 days notice in writing, is really not necessary because the delay reduction orders always send out by routine in these courts, right? And that would always satisfy the notice requirement of section 110. That's your position.
I believe that it does satisfy the delay reduction order satisfies the first paragraph.
In any case?
If it was issued, it would satisfy it. But the court mentioned, there has to be 3 deadlines that are not met, and those are basic deadlines. You first have to serve the defendants. If the defendants fail to answer, you have to move for default or dismiss the defendant. And at that point, the case is at issue and the case can be set. This is not rocket science. These are just basic deadlines that every litigant knows needs to be done. And if the court had, for example, issued an order, please set the case for trial within 45 days or else the case is dismissed, shall be dismissed. I don't think the court has to give another notice in between that time period and say, I meant what I said before. And this is what happened in this case. It's no different. The court set forth the basic deadlines, and after 3 years and 3 months of no meaningful activity, the case wasn't even at issue. The court had enough and dismissed the case. And I think that is well within the trial court's discretion. And I just want to mention that the trial court has broad discretion in controlling its docket. Under Colorado law, the plaintiff has a burden to prosecute. It is not defendant's obligation to prod the plaintiff to prosecute. And the public policy of this state is to resolve lawsuits in just, speedy, and inexpensive manner. And the committee comment rule says right here, the purpose of the practice standard is to encourage prosecution of pending cases and permit the machinery to dispose of matters which are not being prosecuted. And as this court is probably well aware, the Supreme Court has issued a directive having these aspirational goals for trial courts. It sets forth an aspirational goal for trial courts to, I believe, have less than 10% of cases that are not resolved within 1 year. And for each individual judges, there's an aspirational goal of having only 20 cases that go beyond 18 months. So every trial judge is under obligation to prosecute, to move the case along. In this case, we have a case that sat dormant for over 3 years and 3 months without the case even being at issue. The trial wasn't set, no disclosures were exchanged, no depositions were taken, nothing was done.
Let me come back to your language. The clause you're relying on before the or reads, quote, upon 30 days notice in writing to each attorney of record and each appearing party not represented by counsel, close quote, correct?
Yes.
Is it your understanding then that the court could at any time send out any order, and as long as there was a 30-day window, failure to comply with the order could result in automatic dismissal. For example, the court could send out an order saying to the plaintiff, unless you complete the depositions of the defendant's experts within 30 days, you are subject to dismissal. And on day 31, if the depositions hadn't been completed, the court could just dismiss the case?
No, Your Honor. The reason is there's, as the court mentioned, may dismiss any action not prosecuted with due diligence. So there is a requirement that is prosecuted with due diligence.
Well, let's assume that the operative fact meets the lack of due diligence requirement. But you're saying that the 30-day notice can be given essentially prospectively,
yes,
rather than retrospectively.
Yes, Your Honor.
Has there any case, so Colorado case, so held?
I do not believe there's a Colorado case that addressed that precise issue.
Thank you.
May it please the court, in response to one of the judge's questions, and I'm not sure which, was the wording of Maxwell versus the wording of Rule 121 presently. And what I would say, and I think there was a comment made by Mr. Yoon, that of my 17 cases that I've cited, none of them involved a delay reduction order. I'm going from memory, but I believe the Lanes v. Scott case was Denver District Court, and it was Judge Raymond Jones, who later became a judge on the Colorado Court of Appeals, and it was precisely this issue. It was a delay reduction order. Later in the case, Judge Jones issued an order of dismissal for failure to prosecute, and Judge Jones was reversed by the Colorado Court of Appeals. I know there's a Denver District Court case. I'm pretty sure it's Lanes v. Scott. If I'm incorrect, I'll stand corrected, but I think that's the case. Another issue, which is sort of why I asked for oral argument, just because it's very interesting to me. I don't even know if we need to get to that point, because my initial point is that Judge Mullins did not follow the procedural requirements of Rule 41 or Rule 121, and therefore it is a reversal of his order that should be entered by this court. But the one interesting thing that comes up is this Molitor case and the application of Molitor. And both counsel kind of went back and forth on that issue. Clearly, if this court reverses Judge Mullins and remands the case for reinstatement of the case, we don't even have to go to Molitor. But if for some reason the court should choose to look at the case otherwise, then I think Molitor becomes interesting. And to me, it's a mental gymnastics of when and how does Molitor apply and under what circumstances. And the standard premise that Molitor is cited for is that the trial court is divested of jurisdiction and cannot rule on a Rule 60 motion once a notice of appeal has been filed. And that's what we did in this case. Not only did I file the Rule 60B motion, I then filed subsequent motions with Judge Mullins, and I asked him to please enter a ruling either in the nature of a Rule 59 or in the nature of a rule on the Rule 60 motion so we could have a ruling from the trial court. Judge Mullins finally entered an order on July 28, 2008, and says, because the plaintiff has filed a notice of appeal, the trial court no longer has jurisdiction to determine the plaintiff's Rule 60B motion. Therefore, this court will not rule on the motion without a remand from the Colorado Court of Appeals. The difference between this case and Molitor is that in Molitor, the Rule 60B motion was filed after the notice of appeal had been filed. In this case, the Rule 60B motion was filed before the notice of appeal was filed, because at the end of 15 days from the order, I filed the Rule 60B motion, and having no ruling on that 30 days later, the 45th day, I then filed the notice of appeal. So the Rule 60B motion came first. It's to me, it's just an interesting legal issue that that I don't think the court has to even get to. But
your time's limited. Let me try to frame this. So you're saying that obviously, if you win, the 60B issue is moot.
Correct.
Is your concern that if you lose our opinion should make clear that that is without prejudice to the court's now ruling on your 60B motion.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Counsel.
Yes.
Mr. Young said that the default that you, or the defect that you suffered under the delay reduction order was you did not file the default judgment. Again, I don't understand what the position, your position may be on that. I mean, it does say that application for default shall be filed within 30 days after default occurred. There's no question that you served in March and there was no answer filed or any motions for extension of time, correct? Default did occur.
There were two motions for extension of time filed by Mr. Kuhn, one unopposed by me, within which to file an answer on behalf of the PC, mm-hmm. and the court granted that. There was a second motion for extension of time filed by Mr. Kuhn, within which to file an answer or other responsive pleading on behalf of the PC, and the court denied that motion. And actually, it was a motion to file on behalf of both Dr. Kumar and the PC. So there were motions filed, but I'm out of time, but truthfully and honestly, I did not move for default. We were working on the affidavit. It didn't get done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. They've been helpful. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course. I believe that exhausts the morning docket. And the bailiff may announce a recess.
Recess.